It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So today we'll talk about Bodhidharma's seventh and eighth precepts. The seventh precept is no praise or blame, about which Dogen said, "There is no being proud of yourself or devaluing others because there are no such others to devalue." When you devalue others, you are scratching at your body. When you are proud of yourself, you are scratching at the air. So that's what Dogen says. The eighth precept, but that means there's nothing. You know, when you're criticizing others, that's you. That's the same as you. And when you're proud of yourself, there is no self. And then the eighth precept, no hoarding materials or teachings, about Dogen said, when you open your hand, everything is in your hand. When you close your hand, the air is very limited. So what I want to bring up today about these precepts is they both have the same root problem, which is self-clinging or self-attachment. So they're really both, they're derived from the same issue. And that's the issue that we need to be careful about. Here is the seventh precept directly from Bodhidharma. As always, self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of equality, in the midst of identical dharma, identity of truth, no speaking of self and others is called the precept of no praise or blame. So identical dharma, identity of truth. So the ultimate truth is everything is the same. Everything is one. The seventh precept speaks of comparing, I am better than her, or I am not so good as her. Once this comparative stance arises, its inexhaustibility continues because it's a relative concept and has no place to rest. It always moves and it gives no satisfaction. Even one who becomes the most famous man in the world is worried that someone's going to become more famous than me, because now his mind has something, fame, and so then he's eligible to lose this thing. Right behind the love of fame is fear, and there's shame also. Maybe I'm not really so good. This is how the comparative sense works. To go beyond this sense or mind attitude is what this seventh precept is pointing to. And I want to just add that it's a very pertinent precept for artists, because if they start thinking about fame, or for a writer publishing, they lose their intimacy with their art, the very intimacy with their art that makes their art great. If you're thinking about what does this other mind really want to hear, then that's what you're focused on, and not the not yet discovered thing that you're really about in being an artist. So this is a very important precept for artists. And in comparison to what I just said, think of Ryokan, who had nothing. So when a thief came, he felt sorry for the thief and he said, "Here, take my clothes. You've come all this way. You should at least get something." So this is not the attitude of one with a comparative mind. If you've got something, you feel better than those who don't have it, and maybe even want to protect yourself from them getting it. That's more how a comparative mind works. Kobunchino Otogawa has this beautiful thing to say. It's short, but he says, like a scale, always the mind acts to put oneself high and others low. In Buddha mind, there is no such activity. The scale is always level. There are no others. There is no self. Others are self, and self is others. So comparing weights is impossible. Every Buddha and every ancestor realizes that he is the same as the limitless sky. Where every Buddha patriarch realizes that he is the whole sky and the whole great earth, when he appears with a great body, there is no inside or outside. If he appears as a true body, there is no soil on the earth. It means that he is the earth itself. I think those words are so beautiful. A closely related precept is not speaking of others' faults. And that is speaking of others with the intention, conscious or unconscious, to cause disrespect or disharmony between people. The precept means we do not take the hearsay of others about wrongdoings to be true without directly and thoroughly investigating it firsthand for ourselves. More importantly, we do not repeat such hearsay. It isn't just the negative gossip that poisons our mind, but also our passive listening to it. When we listen to gossip, we're as guilty as the gossipy person. Both are implicated in the tendency for its spreading. I want to share a literary example of listening to a person to whom one feels drawn about a person to whom one doesn't feel drawn, which we all do this. We all do this. And the great literary example of this is Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. So I want to tell you just a little of the story and you'll see what I mean. And it revolves around, it's not complicated, so don't worry. It revolves around the Bennet family, where there's five unmarried daughters. And they live in the country where there's an empty estate ready to be rented. And lo and behold, a single man who is rich and handsome, rents the estate. So that's the setup. And at a ball, Mr. Bingley, who rents the estate, sees and falls in love with the beautiful and shy Jane, the eldest of the five daughters. Okay, so Mr. Bingley, who's just rented this estate, and he's single and rich, falls in love with Jane, the eldest of the five daughters. His less socially easy friend, Mr. Darcy, who is even wealthier, appear snobbish and proud. So we have Bingley and Mr. Darcy, and then we have Jane, and Elizabeth is the next oldest, and she's graceful and sharp-witted, unlike Jane, who's shy. And Elizabeth overhears Darcy saying that no one in the room could possibly charm him in the slightest. But despite himself, Darcy is intrigued by Elizabeth, who, despite herself, is intrigued by him. So while the pride of rank and fortune and the prejudice against the social inferiority of Elizabeth's family hold Darcy aloof, the pride of self-respect and prejudice against Darcy's snobbery hold Elizabeth equally aloof. Okay, meanwhile, a military regiment sets up in their town, and Elizabeth meets and is highly attracted to a very charming soldier, Mr. Wickham, who happened to grow up with Darcy and tells her that Darcy has denied him his inheritance. So
we're talking about the precept of no criticizing others, basically.
When Mr. Wickham is criticizing Darcy and to Elizabeth, who already doesn't like Darcy, without even knowing him, it validates her first impression. Okay, so there's that. And then without warning, the Bennets learn that Bingley has left his estate. And then Elizabeth's dislike of Darcy even enhances, because she feels that it's probably Darcy who's encouraged Bingley not to fall in love with someone in a family such as this. And while visiting a friend, Elizabeth sees Darcy again, and he professes his love and he actually proposes to her. So you have to understand, I mean, he's a very wealthy man with a huge estate, and he proposes to her and she refuses. And he says, "May I ask why?" And she says, "You broke up Jane and Bingley you had no right to break them up. And also you denied Mr. Wickham his inheritance." And so Darcy subsequently writes Elizabeth a letter explaining what he did with what actually took place between him and Wickham. Which basically said that Wickham, after squandering his inheritance, tried to elope with Darcy's 15-year-old sister in attempt to gain possession of her considerable fortune. So Wickham, by the way, was the son of a man who for many years had managed Darcy's whole property, and also was the godson of Darcy's father. So they grew up together and knew each other well, and he did get his inheritance and he squandered it. And then after he squandered the inheritance, he tried to get Darcy's 15-year-old sister to elope with him so that he could own basically her, I think, huge, it's a huge amount that she was inheriting. So then this doesn't go on much longer. We suddenly learn that the youngest and very foolish Bennet sister, Lydia, has eloped with Wickham. The news stuns Elizabeth, since the scandalous affair, unlikely to end in marriage, could ruin the reputation of all of the other as yet unmarried Bennet sisters. So when Darcy hears of this, behind the scenes, no one is supposed to know, he What is the word? He gives Wickham money to he propositions basically Wickham to marry Lydia so that they're married, so that Lydia isn't an unmarried woman who ran away with someone and never got married. She has a terrible reputation. And no one's going to marry into that family because it's already poor. And then if it's also disreputable and poor family is not a family that anyone will marry into. Darcy shared with Bingley what Elizabeth basically reported to him, that Jane did love him. And Bingley returns, proposes to Jane, and so they're engaged. And then in the end, Darcy, who has realized that Elizabeth's criticism of him is true, softens quite a bit. And there's an episode where he treats her family extremely kindly, and then he goes out behind their backs and saves their family by paying off Wickham to marry Lydia. So the handsome and seductive Wickham lies by omission to Elizabeth, whose prejudice against Darcy, without knowing him at all, believes everything Wickham says. And Wickham is a scoundrel, and scoundrels will be scoundrels, but based mainly on his looks, really, and his easy lies, Elizabeth believed him, despite what other people were telling her, only to find out that if it weren't for Darcy's intervention, her entire family would have been ruined. So this is the precept: being proud of oneself and devaluing others, putting oneself high and others low, speaking of others' faults. These are the psychological and emotional stances that this precept highlights and prohibits. And Pride and Prejudice is unique. It's written 200 years ago, and it's unique in that it shows the dynamic working in both directions. You know, Elizabeth was proud and prejudiced, and Darcy was proud and prejudiced. So it's a very unusual expose of this very precept of no speaking against of others' faults. One of the main ways that we express our attachment to ourself is a constant effort to present ourselves in a favorable light. We all do this. Even if we don't openly express self-praise, in our minds, we are always monitoring and judging our conduct to determine if it's worthy of praise or blame, thinking of our merits and finding some skillful way to determine if it's worthy. And to let others know about them is a fundamental function of the human psyche. So on a conventional level, this precept is suggesting that we refrain from exercising one of our most natural and basic functions. You know, in other words, we naturally just always are thinking or monitoring our behavior, thinking, is it worthy of praise or blame? And if we think it's worthy of blame, we might refrain from doing it. Or if it's worthy of praise, we might exaggerate it. So I'm saying that this is one of our basic, it's a natural and basic inclination that the precept is saying, don't do. But also on a conventional level, an effective antidote to our tendency to speak of others' faults is the practice of praising and rejoicing in their virtues. So that's the opposite positive quality. Blaming others is the negative quality that we're talking about, and praising their virtues is the opposite positive quality. Dogen says, when we see others' virtues, we should speak of them enthusiastically at the earliest possible moment. Dogen also points out about kind speech. He says, kind speech is not only praising others in a wholesome way with a pleasant voice. Kind speech can bring benefit to the person spoken of and encourage and delight all others who are listening. Kind speech can transform a nation. This is very powerful. But I want to add that to be deceptive, to try to stop self-praising, that impulse, without first uprooting our self-cherishing one, the self-praising might go into hiding. If we don't first, so we need to go after, what we need to go after is our tendency to cherish ourselves. That's why we praise ourselves. And if we try to stop it, if we try to stop self-praising without stopping self-cherishing first, it might go into hiding. And then it would be operating on a less conscious, with less conscious supervision. And so it might be even more harmful. So as long as we cling to the self, the impulse to stop self-praise will be an act of just another act of selfishness. I hope that's clear. Without looking at our self-cherishing, our efforts to stop self-praising will just be another act of self-cherishing. I've said this before, but I want to say it again. Tenshin Roshi, Reb, says that in the realm of Dharma, ignoring the dependent co-arising self is the equivalent of original sin. It is the fundamental human disaster. Not seeing how all beings kindly support and sustain our virtue and goodness, it is possible to speak of our own virtue as something separate from others. In such a state of ignorance, you may speak of your virtue as appearing almost in spite of others. You forget that it is really only due to the support of countless others that you accomplish anything of merit. And indulging in self-loathing won't stop the self-praising impulse either. Thoughts of self-loathing are born of the same concern that generates self-praise. Both self-loathing and self-praise are tools of the service of self-concern. As long as the basic illness of attachment to self has not been cured, self-praise and self-blame will reign supreme. Being patient and upright with this self-centered pain, sets the stage for the desire to renounce self-clinging. So Reb is basically recommending seeing it clearly and entering our tendencies fully and being upright with them, just noticing and realizing and immersing ourselves in our tendencies and just seeing them as clearly as possible. you know, in a realistic way. That's what to do about it. Not to go to self-loathing, but just to be with our tendency to praise ourselves and to measure our actions in terms of what other people are going to think. Be with that thoroughly. That's the main solution. That's the main stance we can take in the face of this human tendency. And then the other one is to develop the habit of enthusiastically praising other virtues the moment you notice them. That's also very helpful. So turning to the other precept, no hoarding materials or teachings, the precept goes, self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of all pervading truth, not to raise hoarding, attaching on any single form, is called no hoarding precept. So hoarding is defined as attaching to any single form. That could be your car, your favorite shoes, your favorite dream, or your favorite Dharma point. Dogen's words on the eighth precept were, and this is a little convoluted, one phrase, one force, myriad phenomena, one truth, one confirmation, all Buddha, all patriarch. It has never been hoarded at all. I'll leave that to you to figure out. Tenshin Roshi Reb says that as soon as we are given something, we should give it away. In 2001, I think, someone gave him a huge house in Mill Valley. It has three floors and many rooms with several decks overlooking different views of seemingly endless forest. And he immediately turned it into a practice place for students. It's run entirely by its own staff of students. And once a month, he holds a one-day sesshin there where people can sit together and practice in a practice setting. And he gives at least one and usually two Dharma talks. And it's a perfect example of his own advice of when you're given something, you should immediately give it away. It's very beautiful what he's done. And then finally, I want to read to you what Koban Chino said to his Zendo students about this precept of no hoarding. When you understand that everything was given to everyone in the beginning, a sense comes that there is nothing to limit this as mine and that as not mine. When you go to the mountain and see a flower blooming, and you pick it up, break it, and make it yours, this is attachment. If you let it be there for everyone and everything, this is what no attachment is. The original meaning, this is amazing to me, the original meaning of no attachment is two characters, stingy and greedy. I might think this is mine and that is yours. The whole thing was given to me so that you cannot take it from me. If you keep something, you may have had the idea that it was possessed by you, but it was not possessed by you. You become very poor by having this idea. Dogen Zenji said, when you open your hand, everything is in your hand. When you close your hand, the air is very limited. Explaining this idea of possession in this very pure way, naturally, you understand this precept. Koban continues, when I say everything is given to you, it sounds like everything belongs to you and you may feel very good. But when I say nothing belongs to you, you may feel bad. even yourself doesn't belong to you. Even yourself doesn't belong to you. You are everything. This means you actually have no self to limit. Knowing this precept is having this deep understanding. Every single thing we appreciate is all public truth and whole Dharma. Teaching is maybe the unseen or spiritual part of truth, and the material or visible part is public truth. Even if a child dies after 1 week, you cannot say she didn't have the whole thing. Maybe you put your idea on this occasion, but she may say, no, I lived enough. Every minute, every second, we are unfolding teachings, and all materials are the dynamics of life. So there is nothing to hoard, not to show, nothing to not show to people, nothing to keep apart from the whole, calling it your own. And I'll add to that, nothing to praise or blame. And this is the point, I think, that unites these two otherwise entirely separate precepts. And yet in ordinary, Coben continues, and yet in ordinary life, we have a dilemma. When someone asks us to help a group or themselves, how do we respond? We seem to see a very unhappy situation in the external world, reflecting different circumstances. Political movements put forth methods to solve social problems, and sometimes you offer your energy, hoping to solve a basic problem. But something is missing when we act that way. This is Coben. Something is missing when we act that way. We are forgetting something. We do not know the reason for their suffering. It could be a national policy, which is wrong, but this approach is a seesaw game. When you press very hard on one side of the argument, you just see half of the situation. If you press the other side, it looks like the right answer is over there. The necessity of acting becomes a big challenge. What to do right now? This is the basic matter. You don't have to start something new. You just live on, going on living. And I'm going to add, and practicing with the problem. For your reflection over the week, here is my suggestion. The root cause of both praising self and blaming others and hoarding is self-clinging and self-attachment. Both stem from a false perception of our existence as an independent individual self. We cannot fully overcome this perception until we awaken and see for ourselves that it isn't true. But in the meantime, we can raise our consciousness to just how strong the hold of this clinging is. And so here are two little exercises to help raise your consciousness to how strong the hold of our self-clinging is. First, looking at your relationship with self-clinging on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the strongest, where would you place yourself? And actually, I asked you this once before, and it would be interesting to note if your score has changed. So I'm asking this again, to look at your relationship with self-clinging, and on a scale of 1 to 10, where do you fall? And if you did that exercise when I asked this before, see what you put then. Then name the ways that you know this to be true. What are some examples, basically? Have a conversation with yourself and ask how you can lessen this attachment. What can I do? And finally, whenever you notice self-clinging in any way, practice everything that comes to me is a gift. So in other words, none of this is mine. I cannot take credit for any of it. None of this is mine. I cannot take credit for any of it. Everything that comes to me is a gift. So this is one exercise in lessening our self-clinging, or raising our consciousness to the strength of self-clinging in our lives. And the second exercise is to look at your relationship with the precept of no hoarding from the viewpoint of cherishing your independent individual existence. So name the ways that you see misuse in both your actions and thoughts, and if possible, write them down for further reference, future reference. Which of the ways bothers you the most? So these are ways that you misuse your actions and thoughts. You're thinking about, this is mine, I want this, that kind of thing. When you catch yourself doing this, interrupt yourself immediately, just interrupt, stop, and remind yourself that everything that comes to me is a gift. And eventually, you'll be able to transform these troublesome and deluded behaviors into enlightened behaviors. This is the gift of the mantra, actually. It helps you. It helps you in this deep process of transforming habits that reinforce delusional ideas. I wonder if you have questions. I'm seeing this question. Thoughts of self-loathing are born of the same concern that generates self-praise. I do both, maybe more loathing than praising. The loathing doesn't feel so much like self-concern as it does a wish for self-annihilation. If I weren't here, I wouldn't be doing either, but that's avoiding reality. I don't really know what to do. Both self-praise and self-loathing are tools in the service of self-concern. The self, me, is the center of both pictures, and the person asking this question is stuck. But if you put in the center, instead of me, if you put the precepts in the center, then they are designed for the welfare of others. And when following them, it makes you a person concerned for the welfare of others. And this is the opposite of self-concern and all of the problems that ensue from that deluded stance. When you consciously practice the precepts and make them the center of your ethical life, after a while, you start having a different feeling about yourself. You'll feel that your life is valuable and helpful to others, and you wish that it would only get more so, not to die. And also, I've mentioned in the past, training. Any kind of training that you undergo, military training, educational training, like in college, it's a kind of training. Even having a job is a kind of training. And the training teaches you to think about the welfare of others. You know, and if you're in the military, they tell you what to do because you're thinking about how you're going to help, you know, help your country, et cetera. But it's a training. It's a training for you. You can't be thinking of your own desires while you're being trained in the military. And the same in a monastery. You have to be thinking about the daily schedule or the chants you're chanting or bowing or whatever, but it's not what you want. You're not thinking about that. Any kind of, and in your job, you have to be thinking about what does the boss want. So these are all things you can do that are ready. Putting the precepts at the center of your life is the best one. It's a terrific one because all of the precepts are considering the welfare of others first. And so then if you orient your life to considering the welfare of others first, that will be an antidote to these two precepts, actually, both of them. I hope that helps. Thank you. In the realm of Dharma, ignoring the dependent co-arising self is equivalent of original sin. Oh, this is a quote, I guess. It's the fundamental human disaster. We've heard this before. I'm just starting to get a sense of how profound this statement is. I guess that's just a comment. But, you know, it's so easy to see how the stance of me versus you, if we fail to place ourselves in a broader context, we're likely to become loathing of ourselves or over admiring of ourselves, and both views bring the false view of self-attachment. You know, even though we can't live by ultimate truths, like we don't exist, we don't exist the way we think we do. That's the ultimate truth. We don't exist the way we think we do as an individual, independent person. We can't live by that. Well, I don't really exist, so I can do anything I want. We have to live by conventional truths, but we still can use the knowledge of ultimate truths to shape the direction that we go in. So if we're trying to make a decision, this or that, as a path, if we know the ultimate truth, we can choose the path that's at least oriented in that direction. That's how ultimate truths can help us. I mean, because all this time you might be thinking, well, why are we even talking about ultimate truths? We can't understand them and we can't use them. So what's the point? And the point is, first of all, ultimate truth is the truth. I mean, that is actually how things are. And so just like, oh my God, just to know that, even though we can't use it, but we can use it a little bit by choices that we make, orienting them in the direction of these precepts, for example, or anything that we, all of the ultimate truths that we hear, we can orient our decisions in our lives toward them. That's how we can use them. I mean, it's easy to think, why are we even talking about this? But think of the people who have never even heard of this. They have no idea. I'm so sorry that there's so few people. I'm not talking about just Buddhists, but the many people who are very sincerely practicing all of the religions, the sincere practitioners of all religions as a group, are very small compared to the whole populace. Not that many people care. That's what I'm saying. And it's, you know, it makes me want to cry, really.
Gail?
Oh, yes.
We have a few questions from the chat box. The first one's another comment. It's, I have noticed for myself that negative self-clinging, like self-criticism, has been more insidious and difficult to change than positive self-clinging, like arrogance. There is something so compelling about feeling aggrieved. Letting go of it also requires letting go of the fantasy that I will be rescued from my responsibility for my own life.
I'm so moved by that. I know. Sometimes it does feel like an enormous burden that we're here, and everything that we have to do to make ourselves into a proper human being. And the only thing I can say, this would be what Buddhism is founded on, really, is the idea of cause and effect, that whenever there's an effect, which, like, we're here, there's a cause which we've laid down in previous lifetimes somehow, And this is Buddhism 101. You know, Buddha, this is the Four Noble Truths. When Buddha was alive, he discovered that all beings suffer. And the suffering that he talked about was birth, old age, and death, sickness, old age, and death, which comes from birth. And that there's a cause of the suffering. That's the second noble truth. There's a cause, and the cause happens to be what we've laid down, the karma that we've laid down in previous lifetimes. And there's a way out. There's a way out of this suffering. That's the third noble truth. There's the way out of this suffering. And then the fourth noble truth spells out the way out, which is the Eightfold Noble Path. And that's this basic idea that Buddha gave us a way out of suffering, suffering being old age, sickness, and death, that we take for granted, that we absolutely must go through. A lot of people don't understand that that's what Buddhism is about. Buddhism fundamentally, its basic premise is everyone suffers. We can't get around old age, sickness, and death. There's a cause of this suffering, which is causes that we've laid down in previous lifetimes. There's a way out of this suffering. There's a way out of this suffering. Amazing. Just think of that. And then here's the way out, the Eightfold Noble Path. We've gone over the Eightfold Noble Path, and I'm thinking actually, and I hope I can work out how to do this, that our next series will review what I just said to you, the Four Noble Truths, and in a slightly different context than before, but in a context that will allow us to review the Four Noble Truths that I just told you what they were, including the Eightfold Noble Path. So it kind of addresses what you just said about the burden of the responsibility for our living, for our lives. It's a great burden. And I'm excited actually hearing this to work harder on this idea that I have for our next series, which will allow us to review this whole thing. Thank you so much for your comment.
The next question is, we are constantly being evaluated, competing for a job, trying to get approved to go to Stanford, making the football team. Knowing this is true, I evaluate myself against others and present myself accordingly. Others might not know I should be more humble. How do I deal with this?
The way to deal with this, first of all, is to enter more deeply into what you just said, the reality of that. Remember that term, friendly conversation? Have friendly conversation with that and remain upright at all times. Friendly conversation and uprightness. And then, even more emphasize celebrating the virtue of others. So even more notice others and their virtues and celebrate them. And guess what? That won't harm your efforts to get yourself together to go to Stanford. It won't harm that effort. You can still hold and make a sincere effort in the direction of your heart, which is the correct thing to do for your life. And at the same time, celebrate the virtue of others as much as you can, enthusiastically, as soon as you see them, as Dogen says, and remain upright in your own insight into how your mind is working to compare yourself. And then finally, that advice of everything that comes to me is a gift. So as hard as I work to prepare myself for Stanford, if I get in, it's a gift. Everything that comes to me is a gift. And even my preparation, even to have the things to prepare yourself is a gift. So all of these concepts can really, really support you in just in a slightly different orientation to get you not out of this habit of self-concern. I think it's very, very deeply rooted because of our misunderstanding of who we are. We really do see ourselves as existing as an individual, independent being. And as Reb said, that's the fundamental human disaster. But until we awaken, we will see ourselves that way. So to just really enter that, to enter that fully and be upright in it, at the same time, be making efforts to, be sitting zazen and other, and have the precepts as the ethical center of your life. Thank you. I think, is there a quick other one?
No, that was the last one.
Oh, good. Okay, because we hardly have any more time. I think maybe that should be the last one. I want to say that Sahar is away at a silent retreat, and she may not return until after the last talk in this series. And she is the one who does the editing and uploading of the talks. So if you don't see the talks right away uploaded, know that they will be at the end of the series instead this time. Because she's away. But I want to thank everybody on my team, including Sahar, who does so much work, and Brendan and Brian, who's here in her stead, and all of you who are here, and all of those of you who take part in these talks by yourselves later. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.